Though experts had predicted that the price of gold would never reach $400, it looks like that figure may be reached by the end of the week. Gold closed today at $383 an ounce in New York and $375 in London, up $22 from yesterday. Given the increased activity in the gold market, it would seem that there would be a concomitant increase in mining activity in the 50th state. But that appears to be only partially true, according to Mark Thomas of Alaska Gold Sales in Fairbanks.
We've established a repertoire with a certain, you know, miners, and that hasn't changed much since we've been here.
So you don't really see that there is a kind of a gold rush here in response to the high gold prices, then?
Not through this office particularly. Right as of today, I've had, you know, lots of phone calls and a lot of people curious, but the actual sales, I'd say, are, you know, I'd say they're kind of on a plane.
Ruth Glavinovich, whose father Carl is an active miner in Nome, reports that in contrast to Thomas's experience, mining on the Nome area has increased considerably this past summer over prior summers. She sums up Seward Peninsula mining activity by saying, quote, gold is the thing and mining has increased. One of the types of changes that has occurred is the transition from a mix of large and small-scale, more or less recreational miners, to a concentration on mining as big business. Jim Madonna of Alaska Prospectors and Geologists Supply says that there's been a change in the clientele of his Fairbanks firm.
What kind of increase do you find in your sales to potential miners?
It's kind of like we've fluctuated back and forth across a line here, and until the end of the year I wouldn't have any, you know, I wouldn't have my finger on the pulse of the increase. I think sales, of course, are up, but I don't know, you know, if it's dramatically or it's just very, you know, kind of a moderate increase. We've had, you know, we're very close to the same amount of sales as we had last year, but the clientele has changed a bit.
How's that?
I mean, we've gone more from the recreational standpoint to the miners who are actually out working all summer. In other words, maybe we had a lot of money in the state here, you know, last year and the year before, and there was a lot of recreation going on. That seems to have died, and now we are more or less catering to the person who wants a larger equipment.
Uh-huh.
So there's an increase in large equipment sales and a decrease and small trade sales.
So for miners and would-be miners, it's both good news and bad news. The good news is that gold is selling for record prices, but the bad news is that the investment required to locate and mine the metal may prohibit all but the serious sourdoughs. Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. The snow hasn't fallen yet in Fairbanks, but when it does, the wolves had better go into their dens and consider hibernating for the season. Why should they change their habits? Because the Alaska Department of Fish and Game has designated several areas in the interior for so-called wolf control this winter. Killing wolves, goes the logic, means there are less wolves to kill moose, and more moose, therefore, for people to kill. A substitution of predators, as it were. Bud Burris is management coordinator for the Game Division of Fish and Game. We discussed the reasons his department has for resumption and potential expansion of wolf hunting.
The basic reason in most of these areas where we're either considering or are going to resume the wolf hunt is to either stop the moose populations from declining further or to increase them.
Why hunt the wolves? Why not encourage trappers to increase their trapping activity, to, if necessary, conduct workshops for more efficient means of trapping wolves?
It takes a lot of concentration on the practice itself, you know, or a lot of effort by the individual trapper. And in this particular situation that we're in now with high fur prices on other furs, it's just not efficient for the trappers, the proficient trappers, to spend that much time trapping wolves. They were much better off trapping marten or lynx or
wolverine.
Yeah, the animals that have equally, much more easier caught and have almost as great or a good value on the market comparatively.
Yeah, I have a problem with that statement. I can't personally see where a person who is a trapper, who spends their winter time, their primary livelihood is trapping, why they themselves could not be the active and effective wolf controllers, which would provide benefits to your department as you see it, and benefits to them as well in terms of revenues from trapping. He didn't answer that question directly, but did suggest one way to encourage trapping.
If you were attempting to encourage trapping, would be to provide an incentive of a bounty, but you must recognize that bounties are very distasteful as far as a large segment of the public is concerned.
The public will be involved in the hunt in designated areas, bounty or no, by a permit system. One applies and one receives a permit. In other areas, not yet determined, department personnel will be the hunters. In terms of the total cost to the department for moose control, how much, given the research efforts, management efforts, issuance of permits, regulation of permit holders, et cetera, auctioning off of the wolf pelts for the ones that the department kills, how much does it cost you per wolf?
I know that we have not sat down and tried to account for all of those costs that you're talking about.
Okay, the benefits of wolf hunting, or the reasons for wolf hunting, is to permit an increase in the moose population so that hunters can go out and kill them.
Yes.
You think that's an appropriate role for Fish and Game, as a hunter advocate?
According to the Constitution of the state, and the laws of the state, that appears to be what the Constitution set up for the role of the Department of Fish and Game. It says manage, enhance, for beneficial uses.
Oh, beneficial uses can be interpreted by different groups in different ways.
Oh, yes, very definitely.
Bud Burris of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. I'm Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. Early this year, Governor Hammond established a telecommunications task force, chaired by Lieutenant Governor Terry Miller. The task force is comprised of elected officials, representatives of state agencies, and representatives from the private sector. RCA Alascom is a member of that joint task force. George Shaganoff, formerly of the governor's now-defunct Office of Telecommunications, was recently appointed Alascom's Director of Long-Range Planning and Analysis. We discussed some of the concerns being considered by the task force, and particularly the issue of telephone service to the bush.
Our principal priorities have revolved around the joint board proceedings, which will determine what amount of revenues will flow to the state to support basic telephone development. Particular emphasis would be placed on rural areas. The congressional rewrite of the Communications Act of 1934, which could have great implications from Alaska's perspective as far as service.
What is the current position on service to bush communities?
Well, the basic position is that service should be provided to bush communities. The real question is, where will the revenues come from to support that development? To provide phone service in every home in a small community would be difficult or impossible if the cost of that service had to be borne entirely by the rural areas.
How do you think the costs should be distributed?
Consistent with the way costs have been distributed in the lower 48, from a historic perspective, telephone service, at least message toll service, has been cross-subsidized by heavy urban users, so rural areas could at least enjoy the same level of service. We've advocated that position continue in Alaska, and that's one reason we have the joint board and I think a fairly unified position between both industry and the state on the need for those additional revenues.
And Alascom will be the prime contender for the service to the bush areas?
I think we would, just from our business perspective. We think there's merit in having a unified long line system operated by one carrier in a state. We're not that large that we think we can afford several long lines carriers. But on the other hand, I think it's important that no matter who provides the long line service, that the recognition for the need for costs to be distributed at least to the lower 48 is maintained. Another point on that, we are not the sole beneficiary. We would be carrying the long lines portion, but we are seeing the development of many small exchanges, some owned by native corporations, that would really have the higher operating cost and receive a great deal of that revenue flow to support that service development.
In terms of continued development of phone service to the bush, currently some communities have no phone service, some have one telephone, and others have several telephones. There's no consistency. What do you see as the pattern in the future?
Well, I think the pattern shouldn't be to establish some consistency. It's very difficult to do that unless you know there are adequate revenues available to support that service. We might see a few more local exchanges develop in some of the smaller rural communities. If that were to continue to escalate and we had no change in the settlement procedure that would flow revenues once again from the lower 48 to Alaska, that probably would necessitate another intrastate rate increase. We know the furor that was raised over the last one, and so now we're getting some very difficult policy decisions as we what burden do we all bear to have telephone service developed in the bush.
So you don't see a time when people in the bush will necessarily have a phone in every home that so wishes?
I do see a time. The task force that I mentioned has several working groups established. One that Alaska I'm chairs is level of service. And we said in that working group that one of the priorities for consideration in a policy mode was that all communities above 100 people would have a telephone established in every home. And in communities below 100 people, we said there should be one or more phones as that can be reasonably bared by everybody, so to speak. So our objective is to provide phone service to all communities in rural Alaska, just like it's been provided to all communities in rural America. I don't think it's changed any, and we're optimistic that we can reach that objective.
Alascom's George Shaganaw. I'm Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. 12 residents of Interior Alaska are among the 20 Alaskans to receive funding from the Alaska Council on Science and Technology. All of the recipients, who will receive grants ranging from $200 to $5,000, say they have ideas for innovative technology adapted to Alaska's needs. Many of the ideas involve transportation and solar energy. David Grove of Fairbanks received $5,000 for the construction of a non-polluting electric car that he claims will run in Alaska's cold winters. Another $5,000 went to Steve and Cindy Tack, also of Fairbanks, for a solar greenhouse, and Mike Potter received $500 to convert a standard electric clothes dryer to oil-fired hot water heat. Other Interior residents receiving funding include three men, Bert Bingham, Ken Kunkel, and Don Luderbach, plan to build a car with a hydraulic propulsion system, Kevin McDougall of Delta for a buried brine-immersed freezer needing no energy source and capable of storing winter cold for summer use, the Galena Regional Learning Center for building a greenhouse heated with waste heat from a power plant, Julie Scott of Camp Bingle for a solar collector for hot water at Harding Lake Camp, Stephen Carney to develop an ambulance spine board, Ted Neville for a small hydroelectric generator, Chris Johansson for a window-placed solar air heater, and Donald Pendergrass to construct a waste crankcase oil-burning stove. What does this all mean? It means a productive winter for many Fairbanksans working on their projects, a vision of tomatoes grown in a solar-heated greenhouse, and the sight of David Grove running, or trying to run, that electric car this winter. Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. Of the proposals for adventure-based education submitted statewide to the CETA Division of the Department of Community and Regional Affairs, only two were funded. One of them, a proposal submitted by Eb Wenrick of Fairbanks. Wenrick's program will begin in October and run at least for the duration of the school year. Why did you submit a proposal for adventure-based education?
There was a need for it in Fairbanks, among the Fairbanks youth. I found a lot of youth of high school age who are not in school, did not have jobs. There are a significant number of youth in Fairbanks area who could benefit from the program, who are on probation or who could be on probation if they had some kind of alternative to going right out into the world to try and find a job or to try and get back in school. Without more inner and outer resources than they had when they went to jail.
So these are for kids that are not part of the current academic population?
Mostly. However, there will be youth. The plan is that there will be youth from in school and out of school, both delinquent and non-delinquent.
Where are you going to get the kids from?
The kids will be referred from various agencies in town, Fairbanks Native Association, the Juvenile Defender, or the Public Defender's Office, Juvenile Intake Office, Division of Corrections, Department of Probation and Parole, and also the Tananaw Chiefs and the Hospitality House. We're talking about high school age youth, and that's meant to be flexible. We're not talking about 13 to 17 necessarily, or 13 to 19, but youth in that area, in that age, who or youth who spend most of their time with people of that age.
What do you think is going to attract the kids to the program?
Adventure, fun, something different. It's certainly better than sitting in jail or sitting at home if the home situation is not pleasant.
Mm-hmm. But you've gotten cooperation from people, say, in the jails, in the corrections department, willing to let you have the kids for a while.
This is being worked out now, mm-hmm. yes, with the Division of Corrections.
Okay, adventure-based education. Now, what does that mean?
I think basically what it means is that you take a person, in this case a youth, and change their environment radically from a position where they often have very little responsibility, where things are pretty much taken care of them, whether they're living in an institution or in the city, and yet they're confused and unable to grow up, mature, because of problems they may have and pressures are too great, and you put them in a situation where they have a lot of responsibility, but it basically revolves around stress and survival, challenge, basic economics, food and clothing and shelter, so that they begin to solve problems, gain confidence. And
it's kind of a humanistic approach.
Sure. A total approach. They're also not only learning things about themselves and how to do things, but they're also learning socialization skills, how to communicate with people, how to get along with people, how to help mm-hmm. people.
What kinds of activities will you be using to do this?
We'll be youth will engage in the Sojourners Wilderness School for 8 to 10 weeks, and out of that 8 to 10 weeks, they'll spend about a month during an orientation phase. They'll have a physical fitness program. They'll have a first aid and safety program. We'll meet regularly. We'll have a couple of short outings. And then they'll prepare for a major expedition, which will be anywhere from 10 to 21 days by dog sled or by skis or rock climbing, mountaineering, or canoeing, kayaking, this type of thing. And then they'll come back and they'll have a follow-up phase, which will last about 2 weeks.
What makes you the person especially suited to do this?
Well, besides my interest, I've been a teacher and a counselor, and I have my own guide service. I've been a guide for several years. I've taught wilderness skill courses at the community college here in Fairbanks, and I've worked with youth at Fairbanks Native Association.
Well,
at the university, I was United Campus Minister for 3 years, and we spent a lot of time there doing a similar kind of thing with college-age students.
What is it about your proposal that you feel made it one of the two in the entire state to get funded?
Probably because I've been in Alaska for a while, and I think my proposal was sort of designed with Alaskan youth in mind and with the kinds of needs and the kinds of situations that youth find themselves in Alaska. Fortunately, I've lived in villages and I've lived in small towns. I've lived in several places in Alaska, so I have some idea of the special Alaskan environment and its demands and needs. I have a feeling that played a big part in it.
Ev Wenrick, I'm Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. If you grew up in the lower 48, you probably remember those signs and buses that read, "College graduates earn $100,000 more in their lifetime," and proceeded to show, graphically, how little those poor folks who didn't even graduate from high school would make in their lives. Well, times have changed, and the advertisements are no longer true. Go to college, and you may or may not even be able to find a job. Dr. Hillard Hoffman has had extensive experience in convincing potential students of the benefits of higher education. He was recently appointed the University of Alaska's Assistant Vice President for Institutional Planning. His duties include admissions policies, procedures, and promotion, the marketing of the university in a time of declining enrollments. What do you see as the trend in enrollments at the University of Alaska?
Well, I don't think that the University of Alaska is any different than any other institution in that the enrollments will be affected by a series of factors. It's not a simple thing to say, well, the population growth is here, therefore the enrollments will increase, or the price is right, therefore the enrollments will increase, or the packaging is very attractive in that it's a beautiful campus and the programs are well presented, therefore enrollments will increase. or that the product is sensational, therefore the enrollments will increase. All of these factors increase whether or not you're going to have an increase, a decline, or whatever happens in your enrollment situation. So it's a very personalized thing. I think the important thing is that institutions have recognized this in recent years. They know one undeniable fact, and that is that during the 1980s, the students are not going to be there.
Why?
Well, they just weren't born in the last 20 years. It takes about 18 years to make a college student on the average,
mm-hmm.
and enrollments have declined in the last few years. For example, last year, the nationwide increase in higher education enrollments was 1%. Translated, what that means is that approximately one half of the institutions had enrollment declines. If you have a stable situation, you have either an up or a down. And if for everyone that went up a little bit, somebody went down a little bit. For everyone that went up a lot, maybe someone went down a lot. The difficulty there is that as we get into the 80s, more and more institutions are going to have declines. You may reach a situation by 1985 where you have 20% of the institutions having increases and 80% declines. At the university, I think that what admissions officers in particular and administrators in general have recognized is that they must increase their opportunity to at least hold their own in a very competitive market. And it's almost like an economics lesson in that you have the various P's that they'll tell you in any elementary course. You have your population base, you have your product, you have your price, and you have your packaging. Now, you better do them all well. One of the most interesting ones in recent years is packaging. You're going to have to make it attractive to the student for a number of reasons. Other than the obvious ones, which are things like, can I get a good job from going to that institution?
Mm-hmm.
If the packaging is presented in a way that the opportunity for getting a good job appears to be quite good, then the student is much more likely to select your institution than another.
In all advertising, the idea is to make that product more attractive than a competitor, to make that soap work better, whereas, in fact, it may not work better. Is that also reflective of university advertising?
I think that is true to a certain extent. The problem is that the quality of the product is very difficult to quantify. Whether or not a school is a good school might depend a lot on reputation rather than fact.
But it is the job of the university planning office, public relations department, whatever, to present the university to investors, to students, to anyone who could conceivably continue that institution to make it look good. No matter, maybe one department has three professors, but they're going to tell you it's a terrific department.
That's right, and I think a lot of universities have done that. I think that a lot of departments have taken it upon themselves to do that. Unfortunately, in my opinion, in the past that has not been done enough. As we rode to the high times of the 60s and the 70s, the universities didn't have to do any mm-hmm. packaging that would make the place attractive. The students were there in great numbers, and it wasn't necessary to go out and recruit, other than to attempt to recruit very good students, which all universities have tried to do all of the time. Everyone wants the National Merit Finalist, but they have not done the kind of job that you see in industry, and they recognize that now, and they're beginning to make large investments in recruiting programs that dwell on the package that they have to offer.
And you think that's a valid way to approach higher education?
Oh, yes, I think so. I think it's a necessity. It's going to be a necessity from the standpoint of not only maintaining the institution from historical and commitment point of view, but also from a budgetary point of view, which is just about as important these days. You're going to have to pay your light bill in 1985, and it's going to be an awfully large light bill, and you'd better have the revenues in order to do that.
Does the University of Alaska devote much time and effort to recruitment, to publicity, commercializing themselves, shall we say?
Frankly, in the past, they have not, and that has been recognized by our new president, Dr. Barton. And I know that in recent weeks and months, he has indicated to his chancellors and to members of his immediate staff that this is an area in which we must become extremely active, and he is accepting the leadership role in doing this. I know that there is, at the present time, there is a tremendous amount of interest in his part in making sure that this institution is attractive statewide and in the lower 48.
Hillard Hoffman, the University of Alaska's Assistant Vice President for Institutional Planning. I'm Karen McPherson in Fairbanks.
A report prepared by a Blue Ribbon group of Fairbanks representatives of public and private sectors states that with regard to locating a gas conditioning plant in interior Alaska or at Prudhoe Bay, quote, neither potential site was investigated in critical or objective detail. That word from Rob Walton of Earth Resources, who has been attending the task force meetings. I asked him what recommendations he anticipated the task force would be making to Governor Hammond.
It's been our impression all along that the task force was headed for a vote to the governor to tell him to go ahead and pursue the court and the FERC challenge. We feel that there's sufficient evidence to warrant pursuing the Fairbanks location. And the problem is that if they don't take action now with respect to the court and the FERC, that study won't be very meaningful because they will have already made the decision and finalized it and will be proceeding with the other alternatives.
But how much chance did Walton think there was of changing the FERC decision on gas line pressure from 1260 to 1680 PSI, the pressure required for gas line between Prudhoe Bay and Fairbanks?
We've had an attorney's opinion show us that FERC did in fact make a mistake in that they took a president's decision, as President Carter, his decision from 1977, as a mandate that the 1260 line should be chosen. And when we read that president's decision, when we had our attorneys read it, we felt that that was an incorrect assumption, that basically the president said, look at 1260 or higher pressure lines. And he did not, in fact, say, you've got to go with 1260s.
Rob Walton. I'm Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. You may think that under state law it's quite all right for you to possess marijuana in your home for personal consumption, but there's a catch, probably at least 22 of them. Two of those catches recently caught up with Sue Delbert, a now former assistant district attorney in Fairbanks. Possession of marijuana is still a felony under federal law, and according to District Attorney Harry Davis, who along with Chief Prosecutor Dan Hickey of Anchorage initially suspended Ms. Delbert and later fired her from the Criminal Division of the Department of Law, possession of any controlled substance by a person employed in a law enforcement capacity is untenable. It is felonious to possess and to be involved in the transfer of marijuana. Ironically, Ms. Delbert's possession of the drug became known after three persons burglarized her home, not due to any declaration on her part. District Attorney Davis defended his decision to remove Ms. Delbert from her duties.
Because of the necessity of the public to have faith and trust in the prosecutors in my office, I think it had a direct bearing upon her ability to continue to be a prosecutor in my office.
Davis went on to explain that he felt that even if the case had not received publicity, it still would have been necessary to suspend Ms. Delbert because the law enforcement community would have been aware of her use of the drug. I asked Davis,
if the burglary of her home had not occurred and the burglars had not informed your department that she had possession of the substance, it probably would never have been known by your department.
That is correct.
And had you felt prior to the knowledge that she had possession of marijuana that her job performance was less than satisfactory?
No.
Administrative action, in this case a two-day suspension, was also taken against another member of Davis's office, Ms. Delbert's supervisor, Assistant Attorney General Natalie Fenn. Why? Because, said Davis, quote, it's mandatory for any Assistant Attorney General to provide information to the district attorney regarding any possible criminal conduct by a fellow assistant in the office, unquote. Well, possible criminal conduct is a pretty wide area. You may have thought that 1984 was a few years away, but at least for people in some professions, 1984 is now. Karen McPherson in Fairbanks.